I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Vicky Vertiz. She's a poet with a new book out from the University of Arizona Press, which, in my opinion, is one of the best independent press for poetry. The name of the book is Palm Frond with Its Throat Cut. It's a beautiful book of poems. But what makes this book so fascinating and compelling for me is that it's not only a book about her, and not only about language, not only about art, but it's really a book about the city of Los Angeles. And she writes about LA in a perspective that we don't often hear. This is not the Los Angeles of, you know, those Hollywood images or LA on the beach and all the blondes playing volleyball or whatever they do on the beach. All those stereotypes of California. This is a unique and very important view of Los Angeles that comes out in these poems. It's a fantastic book. Stick around and we're going to talk to Vicky Vertiz. Vicky Vertiz is a poet whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Wisache, Nepanta, Omniverse, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and anthologies such as Open the Door, The Coiled Serpent, and, too many to mention, actually. She is a 2018 Bread Loaf Environmental Fellow. She is also a participant in Mokanda and Vona, and she was chosen by Natalie Diaz for the 2016 University of Arizona Poetry Center Summer Residency Program. And in other words, she's the real thing. Welcome, Vicky Vertiz, to Words on a Wire.
Oh, thanks for having me, Daniel. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show, especially after reading your fantastic book.
Oh.
Before we get into the book, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came into poetry.
So what I'll say is that I didn't realize that being a poet was in my family until about 10 years ago, when it clicked into place that my mom had been talking about an uncle of hers who wrote poetry and had a whole book of poetry.
Wow.
And was never published, but had, you know, had collected his own work. And then a few years later, hearing that my tío writes verses. So he writes in verse.
Wow.
And he works as a farmhand all over Mexico and, you know, dedicated verses to his sisters and his brothers recently and printed them what we would call a, it was like a little poster, but...
what we would call a broadside.
The broadside, yes. I slipped my mind, but... and realized, like, oh, so...
Wow.
This is in my family in a very interesting way, and it's only been the men at this point who have been recognized for that. So, but when I figured out I was a writer, I had gotten my heart broken... / broke someone else's heart and wrote about it and shared what I wrote with a friend of mine. And she looked at me and she said, "You wrote a story." And I kind of looked at her back and was like, "Did I just do that?" And then she invited me to my first ever writing workshop with Aya de Leon, who runs Poetry for the People at Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
To run it there, an incredible Latinx poet, and realized that there was like a whole world that I needed to look into and was mentored by other women writers from Maywood or LA to continue to apply to workshop in writing, and then just have never stopped. So,
what did you study before you went on? I know you got your MFA at UC Riverside, I believe.
Yeah.
What were you studying when you discovered you were a poet? Because you must have been on another track entirely.
Yeah. I studied political science in undergrad.
No way, me too.
And my first, well, you're going to love this. My first master's was in public affairs at UT Austin.
Oh, my God.
Because I was going to change the world that way.
Wow. Yeah. You
but
might,
I thought.
But you found, poetry found you, or you found poetry, or one of the two.
Yeah, and then realized, you know, after having, you know, been working in advocacy in many different fields for a long time, that I wanted to work, that the arts was the way that I was going to contribute to supporting our young people to be self-determined and for people to be free, right? So, like, actually necessarily through policy the way I had thought, but to be able to tell people who you are instead of waiting for them to tell you, because they will, and they'll make up all kinds of lies.
Do you consciously bring your social activism into your poetry?
I think that when people say that poetry isn't political, they're not thinking about their positionality, about their privilege, about what it means to write as the in the body that they're in. And I've been conscious of the body that I'm in forever, and you know, we're part of, with Latinx communities, we're part of these larger historic dynamics around colonialism and being subjected to all these different kinds of hierarchies. And so I think for a lot of us, we don't have a choice but to know from where we're writing. But yeah, I think it definitely makes its way in.
Yeah, I totally agree that there is no such thing as politically neutral poetry, that even if you are writing a poem about a bottle of Listerine, you're writing about a bottle of Listerine when there's a lot of horrible crap happening right outside your door that you're ignoring. You're choosing to ignore it.
Right. And then there's also, I mean, I do also want to make room for, I've had the privilege of being mentored, I think, by a lot of different kinds of people from all different backgrounds. But one of them, Celia Herrera Rodriguez, is a visual artist and performance artist and writer. Yeah, I got to work with her at California College of the Arts. And one of the pieces of advice that she gave me was that, you know, sometimes you also just need to sit down and draw a pretty flower. And that's okay.
Yeah,
that's,
absolutely.
We as artists need to preserve and maintain our joy and look at beauty, because we too deserve to be
absolutely
looking at that and not just what is hard. So I value that very much, and so try to do what needs to be done. Like, the work kind of will tell me what it wants. I have a hard time sitting down and saying, I'm going to write a poem about immigration. Like, in fact, I haven't been able to write anything about what's happening right now at the border, with children being, you know, separated from their families, because my writing practice isn't direct in that way. I have to distract my thinking mind so that the subconscious can create something.
You know, I totally agree. I think that when we set out to write about a particular issue, to assert a particular opinion, that the poem becomes rather thin. But when we're following language, we're following gut, we're following image, what we truly believe is going to come out on the page anyway, and that's going to be a poem that, yeah, can be political. At times it doesn't have to be, but it can be political. But it's organic to the work and gives it a chance for the poem to breathe, I guess you can say.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's very clear in your poetry. Your poetry, it has a lot of what one might call issues. I'm thinking of the poem Fabrica, which is really a beautiful poem about working in a factory and then the inner factory. Yet I never feel like I'm being preached to. And so who have you learned from who have been incredible political poets, but who have been just incredible craftspeople?
One thing that I'm working on as a U.S. American writer is to read more broadly, globally, right? Because there is such a huge need for us to connect across time and space and land, right? So that's what I'll say that I'm working on. What I'll say next is that my canon is Lorna D. Cervantes. It's Juan Felipe. It's that generation of poets that... But also my mother's tío, right, who was probably also writing verso. So, like, my canon is, like, people who are working class, likely, you know, were at some point in a hyphenated Mexican-American or Latino or Latinx, and risk so much when they share their work, right? So I think of, you know, Roque Valton, if I need to refer to someone who is really risking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Writing, right? And Juan Felipe also introduced me to, like, Nicanor Parra, right? So there's so many different folks, but my immediate canon are those people who have looked at their lives and said, there are these bigger things that we need to connect with each other on. And here's my flor, right? So I'm forgetting Mary Baraka, right? Jim Jordan, of course. Audre Lorde's writing is not necessarily... people who wrote across genre too, right? So I feel like they taught me that our lives, our daily, the mundane, right? Shadi Moraga, of course. The mundane has everything we need to talk about what is in the world and what is harmful and the wounds that we need to go back to and enter and continue to heal. And so those teachers have taught me to go into the thing that's hardest and try to come out. Juan Felipe, also being one of my teachers, taught me to go into the space of no mind at all and no wound at all and see what's beyond.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
The surface, right? The surface. So he's in the flow, I think, constantly, right? He's just open to what the universe is telling him and what the landscape around him is telling him. And so that is really important to me as someone who grew up with things that were very concrete and physically difficult and economically difficult to dream and imagine, right?
Yeah.
Which is what Black futurists also tell us, right? So Fred Moten being a really important teacher of mine who has said, like, we must celebrate and through joy and love explode these harms, these violences against us, because we are bigger than that and we are not anything or anyone that can be taken. Who we are cannot be taken from us. And that's the most freeing thing I think I can follow as a writer, right? Is that we are bigger than our suffering. And so going into and through.
Well, you know, you're saying so many wise and incredible things that I don't know what to focus on, but I love that term that you just, I'm going to attribute this to you for the rest of my life, immediate canon. I think that's a beautiful term because, you know, yeah. And because it parallels, you know, the immediate family. You know, we all have a family, but our immediate family, you know, that is what really influences us fundamentally. But the immediate canon, I think I'm going to start asking guests that, what is your, who is your immediate canon? That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I am talking to Vicky Vertis, author of Palm Frond with Its Throat Cut, a collection of poetry. Vicky, I noticed in your bios, wherever they may appear, you always mention, or the bios always mention, that you grew up in Bell Gardens in Southeast L.A. And I'm wondering, how has L.A., that particular part of L.A., shaped you as a writer?
Oh, that's a great question and so rich for me. So I just returned from the Breadloaf Environmental Writers Conference, I recommend to folks. There are several different conferences there. This one that I just went to and completed reminded me that when I write, location, space, the land, its history are the cushion and context and the it's the world in which everything happens, right? And
right.
I have found that no matter where I am living, home and the land of home and what looks like home continues to be the recurring thread through a lot of my work. And perhaps it's phases, right? Perhaps that someday I, you know, won't be writing about the Southeast as much. But because it is a place that is unknown to many people, that is dismissed when it is known, that those gestures are mirrors to the ways in which working class people, white people included, and Latinos in particular right now, are dismissed and thought of as just not valuable, not good enough, not smart enough, not important enough to care about, not important enough to protect from pollution and environmental harm. So there's so little known about that region of Southeast LA County that by coincidence, my writing keeps going back to that place and wanting to know that place. And that place, including my family, of course, the home in which I came, which is a big metaphor for like dreams and understanding how shame operates in our society. You know, if you don't, and how capitalism kind of infiltrates our emotion and our self-perceptions, right? If you have a little house, what does that mean about who you are? And so it's important for me to say Bell Gardens because it is a town that is, you know, synonymous with people who hustle, people who persist, people who will exist beyond and above what people know of them, if they know of them at all. And there are a lot of different communities in our world that I think can relate to that. So to me, being as specific as I can about who I'm writing about and what places I'm writing about will reach more people, because I think everyone knows what it's like to not feel good enough in some way and to be dismissed. And that's something that I feel like I write to correct. I write to correct harm that's been done to us and a lot of people like us, whether it's women, whether it's working class people, Native folks. It's a suburb of L.A., but it's not what you think.
Right.
And
it's,
so
so
I've spent a good chunk of time in my nonfiction work, too, writing about Southeast L.A. for the local PBS station. I mean, KCET is its own independent public broadcasting network, but I've written about 13 or 14 articles about Southeast Los Angeles in particular, and documenting its cultural existence at the moment, its possibilities, its rental markets, queer and trans families in the Southeast LA region, and how they're fighting to make schools safe for all trans and queer children. So it's really a special place that I think has a lot in common with other places, and that I just love to bring with me and make people aware of its magic and its challenges and its resilience more than anything.
You know, that's interesting, because I think that you could have easily asserted a bio that says, you know, Vicky Vertis is from Los Angeles, or Vicky Vertis is from Southern California, which would evoke something entirely different than Bell Gardens. And perhaps, you know, somebody who's not from California or from L.A. might think of Bell Gardens and it might evoke something completely different. But if you know Bell Gardens, it's very working class, and it's very, it reflects in your poetry. And I think I think there is a significance to coming from Bell Gardens as opposed to coming from Los Angeles. And I'm from Fresno, right? And one of the things that I notice is,
yes,
being from Fresno is it teaches me or influences the way I negotiate the world. And so no matter where I'm at, I think I see things through the eyes of Fresno, including the city of Paris. And I'm thinking of your poem, Honeymoon, about the city of Paris. And I love that, because it's not a romanticization of Paris at all. You know, talk a little bit about that poem, how that poem came about.
One of the metropoles, right, of world, like that center of the colony spring. There's something about duality and complexity that I've been wrestling with in my regular processing of the world and in my writing, that Paris can also be its beautiful macaroon self, and also
I love that, its beautiful macaroon self.
It's just, you know, well, the wine flows on tap at the mall. It really does. And I still got followed by men that looked like me, and people weren't rude as predicted. But I think it's because I spoke Spanish first. And so, interestingly, what that poem is, it's like a synthesis, and somewhat with like a fantastic veneer over my actual first trip to Paris. And I don't know if this happens to you, Daniel, but sometimes you'll write something and then you don't necessarily see what it's about until many reads later.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right? So at first I could have said, like, oh, it's about, it's like a feminist interpretation of a honeymoon, that like someone who, you know, might marry themselves and say, I don't need to be married to a man or anyone else. Like, I commit my life to myself and my love for myself. And yet so many of the themes my work deals with is disappointment, right? Like, you get to your honeymoon, you get followed upstream or or whatever. Or, you know, you get to Paris and your bedroom is a closet, right? Which is what happened to me. So literally it's a synthesis of my trip there. And then looking back at it, what the content is doing is reminding me, it, like, in a way, like, it wants to keep me honest about who I am. Mm-hmm. So, like, saying, you know, the word honeymoon elicits lots of, you know, heterosexual couples, right? And so breaking that down and saying, well, actually, I married myself, and that's why I'm here. So literally that happened. And then that I was reading things that I was comfortable with, right? So queer feminist porn, like, literally walking around the streets of Paris, walking into a bookstore, and the only thing in English was a copy of On Our Backs. And I was like, wow, yeah, thank you.
Nice.
Thank you very much, San Francisco, for your queer feminist porn. I'll take it. Right. So, like, bringing me back to a queer identity that I struggle with as someone who is, you know, very femme presenting as, you know, straight passing in the world, and like how that comes out. And then ultimately surviving these like microaggressions or aggressions from a male gaze, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, documenting it ultimately with the camera, right? Being like, well, here's what I have for you, right?
Yeah, you know, I've talked to women who have walked through Paris alone, and there is a kind of aggression, you know, of being followed. You know, it's an experience that I'm thinking of that video. I don't know if you saw that video. A woman was walking across Brussels, it was, and she had a hidden camera, and it showed how many times she got approached and people following her. And it was a subversion of our experience of what we think about flânerie, you know, walking through Paris, as it could be a different experience. And I think your poem is probably the only one I've ever read that captures that. And Mar, of course, much, much more. But it's a beautiful poem. Let me ask you about, you have a poem in here called Dame tu Hermana.
Yes.
And then you have the poem juxtaposed with the version in English, Give Me Your Sister.
Yes.
And I'm wondering which came first, the English or the Spanish? And then on this particular poem, why did you feel that it needed to be spoken in both languages?
And then that one has the Maipocho Nahuatl, right?
Uh-huh.
So both of them have it. So the poem I wrote it in Spanish first.
Oh.
And held on to it for many years and left it alone. And then when the opportunity came to publish a collection, I translated it. And I've also begun to translate friends' work. Because there's a huge need for native speakers to be translators from
right.
English to Spanish, Spanish to English, or third languages, whether that be the Spanish or Nahuatl, or however you arrange the hierarchy of languages in your spoken word life.
your immediate right, so, linguistic palette.
Yes, exactly. Precise. The immediate fill in the blank will be good for us for everything. And so having written in Spanish and then translated into English, in this pursuit of trying to make it accessible to more folks in the Spanish that I grew up with in my house.
Right.
Not necessarily the one that I learned at school or the one that translators use for exactness.
Right, right.
Right. And there's lots of different ways to approach translating. You know, that's a whole field in and of itself, right? But I wanted to have both things together because what I have noticed in translation for me and likely what happens with other folks is that as a native speaker, because I have both languages working at the same time, when I translated this into English, in turn, it started to change. So the path of the stanzas and the direction started to change, and I added other details in English and then realized and then went back to the Spanish and tried to fix
wow,
it because
that's interesting.
I'm fixing, right? It's yeah. iterative. And what I realized is that if I keep doing that, I'm never going to finish.
Oh, my
and
God.
So,
that is really interesting. That would change and that you would go back and change the other one. And wow, what an experience.
And then realize at some point I had to stop and say, okay, you know what? They are different. I understand that they're different. What does this mean about translating that I can highlight and accept for myself?
Right.
Not as a cop-out, porque no pude, porque bien puedo, and I've done lots of whatever. I exact translate what I need to. But the point is that as an artist, there is a space, a third or fourth space that you're working in and creating in where you don't have control, and exactness is not what should be desired. The mess, I think of Doug Kearney, right? Like mm-hmm. the mess can be the object to be with and say, this will continue. Like this is just one movement, right? I'm interested in what's broken and what I don't know.
Right.
So leaving those as not matching exactly poems that are next to each other, they're just entirely reflections of one another, that would be like infinity mirrors, right? That's really how they look to me. I'm like, well, I can keep going. I can just keep changing these forever.
Wow.
But how is our identity as Latinx people that those infinity mirrors, right? Like, yes, those are all seemingly the same version of you, but is it? And that looks like it's in another dimension and
wow.
another time. So just trying to hold those things together. And
well, you know, you're making me think that you could write an entire book that way, you know, just like
oh, yeah.
a primary text, and then you translate it, and then that, you know, deepens it, and then you go back and you deepen in the other language and just back and forth. And wow, that would be a really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the poems are wonderful. And the book,
oh, thank
the
you.
Book is called Palm Frond with Its Throat Cut. And it's, I guess it was inspired by a sculptor named Danny Járegui.
Yeah.
And I looked it up, but I'm wondering just really quickly, we're running out of time, but what was it about this work of art that inspired you to put together this poem and to allow this poem to be really the anchor for the entire book?
Gosh, you know, I think of poet Marisela Norte and her beautiful work in Peeping Tom Tom Girl, right, that really documents what an urban Latinx-centered looks like, what that gaze sees. And I've worked with visual art to have that be my avenue into my subconscious, to be able to talk about all of these different things like environmental racism or the patterns that we repeat that our families give us or teach us. And so reading through Phantom Sightings, the catalog for Phantom Sightings, which is art after the Chicano movement. So it's a show that traveled And I use that catalog to respond to the different images, installations, sculptures. And palm frond stood out. It was between palm frond and Marisela Norte's photographs of LA that she's taken from the bus as someone who doesn't drive. It was between both of them because the way that they view this land and the people on this land is not represented nearly enough, right? Mm-hmm. But palm frond with its throat cut tells me that there is danger where I'm going, or perhaps there was danger where I was, but it is also beautiful and somehow necessary, right? And so there's this palm frond that has fallen off of the palm. It was ya era hora, mm-hmm. like I had to say. And in LA, those palm fronds can be really dangerous. They can be really heavy. They wow. can injure people. They make a big mess. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's a little palm and it just falls, right? But those palms are not native to this land. They also represent this exoticized idea about
Yeah, they're not native obviously. To the land, yet they're so much part of the land's identity.
Right, and it's false, right? But it's also here. So his image, to me, conveyed this kind of desire to love something that is dangerous and complicated and absolutely not what you think.
Wow.
Right? So the LA youth thought was here. It never really existed and it never will,
right.
But there is something really important and there's good stuff here that you should want, that people do want, and that's why we have the housing crisis. But right,
can you read that poem?
Yeah, sure.
We're running out of time, but I'd love to hear you read that poem. It's rather short, but it's just really beautiful, and maybe you can share it.
I would love to. So I'm going to finish here. But what I wanted to say, too, was like, yeah, so LA is not what you think, and part of it is dead. And so here's what I have to offer for you instead of what you think LA is.
Wow.
Okay, palm frond with its throat cut. There is no one else but me for you. The shape you're in, what are we but lying single surface? Subatomics, your fronds decay. Your remaining life is spiky particles. A golden rot. Don't think. Tilt. You'll want to leave me, but let me smoke you down and the tallow of your heart. Wait to fall on my body. Aestheticize me. Make me grass.
That was Vicky Vertis reading the title poem from her new collection of poetry called Palm Frond with its throat cut. Vicky, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Excited to have been here and connecting to you and Lilia Olivas. I love the work that you're doing, and thank you for doing it now. And we need it, and we will continue to need it. So, mucho gracias. Mucho aprecio.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Vicky Vertis for joining us on the show, and read the book. It's a fantastic book. Get the glimpse of LA, but get a glimpse of a lot of other beautiful things as well. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining us. Thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and we will see you next week.